15 miles per hour. It's 5 p.m. Keepin' the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keepin' the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Jim Quigley, who's the director of the Center for Sustainable Energy in New York. We're talking with Jim by phone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can, Steve. Thank you.
Oh, good. We have a good line. Jim, why is sustainable energy particularly important today?
Well, first let me thank you, Steve, for the invitation to be on your show and send my greetings to your listeners. I'm in New Jersey, and I'm delighted to join you on behalf of the Center for Sustainable Energy at Bronx Community College, City University of New York. Sustainable energy, I believe, is critical at this time, not only to our economy, but to our environment. And I'd put it in two essential components. First, we have this approaching calamity of global climate change, which we do a lot of talking about, but we've done little to really address it. Secondly, we have a war in Iraq, which few people would argue is really not about oil. If Iraq were exporting bananas as their major export, I doubt that we'd be having a war in Iraq. We have an economy that is fueled by a depletable, unsustainable fossil fuel, and we have very little infrastructure in place to accommodate the inevitable decline of that resource, and we really must busy ourselves in preparation for that. Sustainable energy gets to renewable energy.
Now, how did you first get interested in this whole field?
I'm happy to say that I spent 3 years in the 1970s as a volunteer in the U.S. Peace Corps program. I had the privilege of living with a group of people on a small island in the Pacific, a group of people who lived at a maximum of 12 feet above sea level, and people who will more than likely have to abandon these low-lying atolls in the Pacific as sea level rises, and it is rising. I saw the winds playing against the swaying palms for weeks on end during my early time at the on these islands and thought, well, what they need out here is a windmill. Mm-hmm. So I went about raising some funds and getting some people together, and we constructed a windmill. And I have since recognized that use of renewable energy, wind, solar, is sensible from the standpoint of sustainability, because it's inexhaustible. At least as long as the sun is shining, it's inexhaustible.
Where did you go after the Peace Corps?
I spent a year working with the U.S. government as a recruiter for the Peace Corps. I had the happy a task of talking about what I had just done for 3 years, and went around college campuses in in Ohio and Michigan, recruiting students who were interested in this possibility to consider joining the Peace Corps. And following that, I got the academic bug back in me and returned to school and did some graduate work and eventually earned a PhD and did some teaching and became involved in a number of environmental activities.
And where did you get your PhD?
University of Pennsylvania in City and Regional Planning.
And in terms of your work in New York, you're director of the Center for Sustainable Energy there in the Bronx, part of the City University of New York. What does the center do?
It's essentially about two things, Steve, workforce development and public education. We're instituting new degree programs to train students in what we would call energy services technology. It's essentially the built environment, looking at heating air conditioning, ventilation systems, lighting, the way the built environment structures essentially use energy. And the second part of that degree program is alternative fuel vehicle technology. Our college happens to be the only one of the City University's 19 campuses that offers an automotive degree program, training in automotive technology. And we believe it's very important to introduce students in such a program to the alternatives to conventional internal combustion engine propulsion systems. And we're very pleased to see developments of hybrids. Of course, hybrids use gasoline, and but at least use it with twice the efficiency of a conventional car. And then there are other fuels such as compressed natural gas and electricity, and ultimately hydrogen. There are some prototypes, vehicles that do run on hydrogen, and there is a great deal of talk about it. We haven't seen hydrogen get to any mass production scale at this point, but many people hope and believe it will happen. And we'd like to be in a position of introducing such curriculum if at such time it becomes available. The public education side of what we do is conferences, workshops, seminars, newsletter, website, email broadcast, and such.
And an occasional radio program.
And an occasional radio program. And again, I'm delighted to be joining you today.
Now, when you were back as a graduate student at University of Pennsylvania in urban planning, were there very many of your colleagues at that time, professors or other students, who were interested in sustainable energy as part of that program?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I have to tell you that the reason I chose to go to the University of Pennsylvania was that at that time, there was a new program in what was called appropriate technology, and the principal lecturer for the program was a wonderful fellow named George McRobey. And George McRobey is a colleague of the late Fritz Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, Economics as Though People Mattered, in which he promoted production by the masses rather than mass production, the Gandhian idea, the idea of small-scale, easily duplicated, nonviolent from the standpoint of culture and environment technologies that could be spread out into developing areas. And I believed that McRobey was a visionary, and I was very pleased to be part of that program and be introduced to these ideas of sustainability.
Now, since you're at a college in New York that deals with some very practical aspects of this, are people surprised when you refer to people like Gandhi?
Well, I think the Mahatma was a man of great practicality, and that he believed in getting people involved in, for example, making their own clothing from spinning their own yarns and threads, rather than importing textiles from Britain. And he also led his people into a very practical approach to their own self-government. It was a major shift in history when the British finally had to leave India and give the people of India their independence.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Jim Quigley, who's the director of the Center for Sustainable Energy in New York. Let me encourage listeners who have a question or comment to join the conversation in Champaign-Urbana. There are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it would be a long-distance call for you, do use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, and that includes listeners on the Internet. And I see we have a couple callers already. Let's go to our toll-free line, line 4. You're on Keeping the Faith with Jim Quigley. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. What a timely subject and time to be on. I guess my thoughts go to, I think there is a sort of paralysis when one hears almost nightly that there is global warming and the energy prices going up. And I guess what I see is numbers of people who seem either numb or basically skeptical that global warming is occurring. In my opinion, I think it's very self-evident, and that many of the scientists are rather cautious and conservative types that are talking about it. The question I would have is, what specific things can one do at the grassroots level, both in one's own personal lifestyle and political-wise, to make a contribution to the issue of the shortage of oil and changing climate?
Thank you for the question.
Well, my thanks to the caller for that question. It's a profound one, and I will confess up front that I am not an atmospheric scientist. I'm not a meteorologist, and I'm not a physicist. In fact, I can report an event we're having later this week at our college in New York. It will feature a keynote address by a man named Michael McCracken, who is the chief scientist of the Climate Institute in Washington, whose writings on climate change had made him a target of the Bush administration, and Dr. McCracken was dismissed early after the Bush administration came into office. Dr. McCracken's sobering analysis is that climate change is occurring, and that it is affected, it's accelerated by human activity, essentially the mass combustion of carbon-based fuels and the loading of additional carbon into the atmosphere. Now, that said, it does get to the caller's question that it's somewhat gloomy, and he's really struck a nerve with me, because I shrink from leaving people feeling that there is gloom and hopelessness. There's so much we can do. I think the first thing we all have to do is to talk about this issue, to get the dialogue going, to get people discussing it. I was surprised to see on a big billboard on Interstate 80 here in our area a Coca-Cola advertisement, and it showed a bottle of Coke tipped and obviously pouring, and it proclaimed global cooling. That struck a nerve with me, because it was almost an admission that, okay, global warming's taking place, here's a way to cool it down, we're going to do our part, here's Coca-Cola. So it made me smile. But I think it's the dialogue, the need to talk about this. I find it almost appalling that there's so little of this dialogue amongst our national leaders. I was pleased that former Vice President Al Gore just last week delivered an address on this, and apparently he's speaking to crowds around the country. There are many people who are doing this, of course, people such as Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute in Colorado. He's widely regarded as one of the leading experts in the country on energy analysis and energy issues. His book, Soft Energy Paths, was a call to energy conservation, and that was several decades back. I don't know if I'm really addressing the caller's question directly, other than to say I really think we need to have everybody talking about this, learning about it. And as we learn about it, we learn that we can moderate the problem by using energy more wisely. To the extent we load less carbon into the atmosphere and use more renewable energy, we're going to moderate the problem. I guess I should leave it at that and let someone else get a word in here.
We have a couple other callers waiting for our guest, Jim Quigley, director of the Center for Sustainable Energy in New York. Let's go to line number one. Thank you for waiting. You're on Keeping the Faith.
I'm calling because I'm really pleased to be talking to you. I just came back from Brooklyn, actually, and I was really despondent and disheartened when I saw how much trash was on the streets and how New York seemed to be really over-consuming. And I was surprised to see that in New York. I don't know why. I guess I had a different picture of New York. But I'm the sort of vegetable-growing reusable bag kind of Urbana person who really believes in trying to consume less. But I found that there's sort of a consumer loop you find yourself in if you're somebody who's interested in conservation and in renewable energy. And that loop is sort of, okay, you go to the farmer's market, you make sure you bring your own bag to the grocery shop so you don't have to use plastic bags. But then there's sort of a roof, a ceiling that you hit and you just can't do any more beyond that. And I'm very interested in renewable energy, but if I look for renewable energy sources for my home in a residential sense, I see that there's no practical application for my house. I can get a high efficiency furnace, and that's sort of it. I can't really go beyond that just because of the level of technical expertise and because of the shortage of goods that I need for like a solar panel or something like this. And I wanted to know, do you see the renewable energy market extending into residential homes in the Midwest, and what is it going to take for it to get here? And then I have another question after that, if I have time, but I can stay on the line.
Sure, hang on.
There are many things homeowners can do to use energy more efficiently and use renewable energy. Fortunately, in some states, there are tax rebates. There are actual grants available. New Jersey is one. The New Jersey Board of Public Utilities provides up to 80% of the cost of the installation of a PV, a photovoltaic, solar electric array on your rooftop. Furthermore, you'll get a tax rebate from it as well. California is doing this. There are some other states that have these incentives. That is a great boost to the market when these sorts of government supports are available. It would seem to me that prudent politicians trying to reduce our dependency on imported petroleum and on fossil fuels generally would pass legislation that would provide incentives for homeowners to use more renewable energy. I have a friend who is a physicist, teaches physics at a college here in New Jersey, who designed his own home, and his home is a net energy producer because he has such a sufficient insulation in the design of the home and such sufficient passive thermal gain from the sunlight with various ceramic materials and stone inside his house absorbing the heat that it radiates heat during the evenings. And he has a small wind generator. He has a PV array. And during the day, when he's using very little of electricity, essentially running his refrigerator and a few small appliances, a clock and that sort of thing, he's running his electric meter backward. So essentially he's selling energy. He's putting electricity into the grid. And of course, when there's no sun in the evening and he's at home and his family is using various appliances, they're taking electricity off of the grid. But in balance, he's producing more energy than he's consuming. If we had the sort of vision among leadership in this country that would promote this kind of idea, from state houses to city halls around the country, we could literally change the course of history in our own country.
Let's go back to our caller on line one for her second question.
Well, my second question is, how can you picture somebody who doesn't come from a physics or an engineering background becoming involved in the renewable energy industry, to be employed in that industry?
Well, that gets to the public education agenda that I was describing earlier. And that we do have a long, long way to go with the general public and making people more aware of how they can make these changes. And it requires money, too. Of course, some people are living paycheck to paycheck, and they're just barely able to pay for a sufficient amount of fuel oil in their homes. Or when that natural gas bill comes, some people are sitting around keeping one room warm because they can't afford to heat their entire apartment or their home. And I think we're going to probably see more of that this coming winter as we see spikes in the price of fuel oil, especially in the Northeast, where some 60% of the homes in the Northeast are heated by fuel oil. and a lot of that fuel oil comes from imports. The imports are essentially Canada and Mexico, more so than the Middle East, but the entire oil markets affect that. But I'm straying from the subject. The issue of getting people educated is so critical here, and there are various programs at trade schools and colleges and universities around the country where we see sustainable energy curriculum being offered, where we see workshops on the installation of photovoltaic arrays, where we see workshops on how to do energy conservation in your home. One of the wonderful programs that the federal government has on this, which is promoted by the U.S. EPA, is called Energy Star. And you'll see them in appliance stores, for example, refrigerators, televisions, electric fans, air conditioners, those sorts of things, where they have been rated in a way that show that the amount of electricity they consume to the work that they produce has a very high efficiency, and therefore they'll get an Energy Star rating. I think we should be seeing Energy Star ratings on buildings. If, for example, a government agency, take this, the city of Champaign, has a new school that they're going to construct, that there should be some criteria that the city says, if you're going to build a new school for us, it must have the following features. One of those is energy efficiency. You might throw in a few others, such as lower toxicity or non-toxic materials in the construction, or products that come from recycled materials or can be recycled if the building is demolished, and better use of available sunlight, better use of rainwater. There are all sorts of things that can be done to a building to reduce its impact on the environment. And I just want to say one more thing with respect to that. There's the U.S. Green Buildings Council that is made up of a group of planners and architects around the country. And they've established something called LEED, L-E-E-D, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And they have these what are called green building criteria. And it's a whole litany of what would constitute a building that meets these criteria, that this green criteria. And I'm happy to report that many schools of architecture around the country are introducing these ideas to their students.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Jim Quigley, director of the Center for Sustainable Energy at Bronx Community College, part of the City University of New York. We have a caller who's been very patiently waiting on line two. I want to get to that call, but let me first give the numbers for other callers, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. We'll put you on the air on this live program. Elsewhere, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. To line two now. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Actually, I was waiting patiently, but I was thinking about things as you were talking. I had a comment about the last caller's first question, where she was saying that she hit a sort of ceiling in trying to do things in using alternate energy sources. One of the things I've found in my home that's quite low-tech is looking for ways to conserve energy, which there are lots of those, and they can be very substantial in the amount of energy that you actually use. My primary question is having...
Would you give us an example or two before you ask your question?
Oh, sure. just adding insulation, making sure that all the little cracks that are available for air infiltration are filled, perhaps doing something, retrofitting windows. You can get, even for older homes, you can get window frames that actually fit in the casements of your windows, and it's relatively easy to install those. You just take the old ones out and put the new ones in, and you can have thermal pane new ones. My primary question has to do with a product that we produce a lot of in this area from corn. It's an alcohol that's added to our gasoline, and I wonder about how efficiently we do that and what the net result in terms of energy consumption is, because I have to think that there are tractors out there that that are being used, or are farm machinery that are using gasoline to produce the corn. Do you know if there's been kind of economic research that has indicated what the net benefit to energy consumption is of this kind of fuel production?
I'd like to respond to your first point and then get to your second one about energy conservation in your home. And there are many wonderful examples, and you used several very good ones. Another one, of course, has to do with a device in your thermostat that can throttle back your furnace in the evening, and if you're away during the day, and turn it back on before you arrive home. And, of course, there are timers and motion detector switches that are fairly inexpensive that will cause lights to shut off at certain times, or lights to come on as somebody might enter a room. These are being used in a much larger scale in public buildings, for example. And there are many others we could talk about. Getting to your question of ethanol or bio-based fuels, I know there's been a great deal of debate about how much energy is required to produce the fuels versus the amount of energy that you can actually use to produce work. In other words, input and output. Is the input greater than the output? Some argue that it is, depending upon the type of agricultural input. There's a, I think a, he's either a chemist or a physicist at Cornell, a fellow named David Pimentel, who recently made a splash in the dialogue about this around the country, claiming that ethanol uses more energy than it actually produces. And naturally, the industries that do this and are trying to make profit at it claim that he's mistaken. No, that his data are wrong, there is more energy. There's less energy produced, or rather, I should say, less energy consumed in the production of the fuel. But it does raise a fundamental issue. If, for example, we had no more oil, could we grow enough crops to propel or to fuel our transportation infrastructure? Clearly not. It'd be impossible. But that helps me at least underscore this point. And it gets to a simple act of that is well established in science called electrolysis. And you can take water and break it down into its two constituent parts, essentially hydrogen and oxygen, through electrolysis, and create hydrogen as a fuel. And it's being done an increasingly larger scale. But, of course, doing that requires energy itself. And there's a debate going about what type of energy should be used to create hydrogen. Some claim that we can do it with nuclear power. Some claim we could do it with more coal combustion. Obviously, there are serious consequences to both those technologies, namely, where are you going to put radioactive waste? It's essentially there in perpetuity. Where what happens with the combusted coal? Well, that's more carbon loading and acid rain. I'm simplifying this. There's more to it than that. But the point I want to make is that in Arizona, using only 10% of the landmass, and you can do this with simple calculations. The data are there. Your average high school math student could come up with this result. Given off-the-shelf technologies you could buy today, and given they're operating at only a 10% efficiency, which is fairly low output, average photovoltaic arrays today covering 10% of the landmass of Arizona could produce the entire electrical demand of the United States. Now, obviously, you can't cover up 10% of the landmass of Arizona and distribute electricity all across the country from that one point. But when we stop and think about the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of acres of empty roof space on buildings around the country and in parking lots and shopping malls and the like, and that they typically heat up when the sun is hottest and when people have the greatest demand for their air conditioners, is the very moment at which these photovoltaic arrays would have their greatest output. We could have a surplus of electricity. Wind, for example. If you put wind farms across the state of Minnesota, and I'm not suggesting that the entire state of Minnesota be converted into a wind farm, but just in the state of Minnesota, with its existing ambient winds, that there'd be sufficient amount of electricity generated from, again, off-the-shelf technology to supply the entire electrical output of the United States. If we put wind farms and valleys and coastlines around the country and a sufficient amount of PV arrays around the country, we could be producing a surplus of electricity that could be used to in electrolysis to create hydrogen and propel our vehicles down the highway, expelling nothing more than water vapor.
You're listening to WILL AM 580, a radio service that is listener-supported and a program of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. This is Keeping the Faith. I'm your usual host, Steve Shoemaker. And our guest today is Jim Quigley, who's director of the Center for Sustainable Energy in New York. We have another listener waiting on line four to talk with our guest. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I'd just like to tell people that there's an online newsletter you can get for free called RenewableEnergyAccess.com, and they'll tell you about where you can buy photovoltaic panels. It'll tell you like what jobs are available and where you can get trained, and a whole bunch of good stories, like he was just explaining about the windmills and all that kind of stuff.
Repeat the address, please.
It's RenewableEnergyAccess.com.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the contribution. Before we go to other callers, let me take just a moment, since we're about halfway through our program today, to say a word about the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is a supporter of this program, and the Y is the oldest student organization at the University of Illinois, oldest continuous student organization. We began in 1873. I wasn't there at the time, but the Y has been active on this campus now in its, I guess, fifth different building on Wright Street over all those years. We're currently looking at the Y, seeing what changes we can make in our 1937 building that we live in to make it more green, more energy efficient. And so we're exploring what can be done in terms of renovation. And I want to ask our guest in just a moment some suggestions he might have for our project, since that's very much on our minds at the University Y. Coming up at the Y this week, we have some special programs. On Tuesday at noon, part of the Know Your University series, which is supported in part by the Office of the Chancellor here at the university, we'll be talking about the relationship of the University Y to the University of Illinois, and our program director, Rebecca Guyette, will be speaking, talking about current programs and the history of the two institutions here in Champaign-Urbana. On Friday, another noon lunch program at the Y. You may bring your own lunch, you may buy a lunch at our Thai restaurant, or you may simply come and listen to the program, the lecture, on October 28th, this Friday, at noon, as part of the Friday Forum series. We have Extending Our Conscience Overseas, and Engineers Without Borders will be speaking. Many people have heard about Doctors Without Borders, who take medical care around the world. Representatives of Engineers Without Borders from the University of Illinois will be talking about their program dealing with the transfer of engineering knowledge overseas and the impact it's having on the development on developing countries. So that's Friday at noon at the University Y, and the other program I mentioned, Know Your University with Rebecca Guyette, will be Tuesday at noon at the Y. If you'd like to make a reservation for a lunch at our Thai eatery, please call 337-1500 to make a reservation, although, of course, you can come even at the last minute. Another of the university-wide programs is CUMUniversity, and at this point in the year, we're looking for teachers who might like to teach a class in something they know about, something they're excited about. It might be renewable energy. for our semester beginning next January. These are non-credit courses taught by people who are knowledgeable, who volunteer to do it, but can also earn a little money doing it because we charge small fees to people who want to take these courses, maybe students at the university, maybe community people, and the instructors get half of the money for it, and the university-wide gets half, and we provide the space for the classes at 1001 South Wright Street out on the university campus. I've been asked to make an announcement about a special program coming up tomorrow, Monday, October 24, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Illini Union in room 314. There will be a program on Introduction to Hiyan Buddhism. The speaker is Haiyun Jimeng, who's director and head monk of the Great Haiyun Temple in Taipei, Taiwan. That's Monday, tomorrow, 3 o'clock, room 314 in the Illini Union on the university campus. And then on Tuesday at 1 o'clock in room 405 of the Union, there'll be a seminar on Haiyun Chan. The speaker is an expert on meditation practice, and this program is being sponsored by the Religious Studies Program, the East Asian Language and Cultural Department, and the Prairie Zen Center. Well, let's get back to our topic for today. We're talking about energy conservation. We're talking about renewable energy via phone to New York City, well, actually to New Jersey, although Jim Quigley is director of the Center for Sustainable Energy in New York at Bronx Community College. Jim, I was mentioning that at the University Y, where I'm the director, we're currently looking at a 70-year-old building almost and trying to see what can be done, since it's physically sound, to bring it up to standards in terms of being green. What suggestions might you have?
Several, Steve. And again, I want to thank you for the invitation to be on your show today. I also want to take just a moment to thank your previous caller about giving a plug for renewableenergyaccess.com. It's an excellent newsletter. It's free. It's available online. There's another one, too, I just wanted to alert your listeners to. It's ENN, actually Environmental News Network, ENN.com, another excellent free online news source that has a great deal of information about the very issues we're discussing right now. And one plug I'd like to put in for our own website of our Center for Sustainable Energy in New York, and that's simply CSEBCC.org. That's CSEBCC.org. In regard to your question about improvements in your building, I would strongly recommend that you get in touch with an architect named Randolph Croxton. Randy Croxton Associates of New York, they certainly could advise you of other architects who have a knowledge of retrofits. Croxton did a wonderful retrofit of a couple of major structures in New York and many others as well. The Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Defense Fund, two different offices, two different buildings in New York that were old buildings that were retrofitted, and they maximized the use of daylight. And many buildings are outfitted with electric lights that that are consuming electricity unnecessarily when simple designs with reflective surfaces, you can create what are called light shelves and duct work that reflects light to the interior of a building, and that the actual illumination of the building is controlled by rheostats that will brighten up the interior as the sun diminishes or reduce the electricity as the sun brightens. Those are the simple devices that are increasingly available now, and the architects who know how to use these can outfit your building with such devices. Of course, insulation is important. The correct selection of window treatments glazing that minimizes thermal loss. And I'd like to observe that geothermal is increasingly cost-effective as a way of heating and cooling a building. Geothermal, not from the standpoint of some seismic activity that you might tap into, like a geyser. It's more the sense of a thermal storage below ground. And this is done with simple drilling of wells. They're not very large. They're high-density polyethylene pipes that distribute a fluid below the surface of the ground. Could go a couple of hundred feet or more. And these geothermal wells will store heat for you to use, say, in the winter, because you might have an exterior temperature of 20, 30 degrees, and yet the ground temperature might be 40, 50, 55 degrees. And that's a sufficient thermal gain that would reduce your consumption of fuel to heat the building. And these thermal efficiencies actually pay in the long run for the installation of these geothermal devices. Similarly, in the summer, when it's 80, 90, 100 degrees outdoors below ground, it might be 60, 55, 50 degrees. And so there's a big thermal difference between those two. And again, simply circulating this coolant or this liquid through your system, just like you would in a hot water radiator, you can help chill your building with this thermal mass. And there are a growing number of companies that are capable of doing these installations and can give you what any customer would expect, which is what's the math? What's it going to cost me, and how soon before this thing pays for itself? And they can give you some good numbers on those. And it would seem that anyone about to make any major renovations of a building, especially a public building or a building that's semi-public, that you would want to get, say, two or three opinions. If somebody tells you you don't have long to live, well, you want to go out and get other opinions from other doctors, and maybe, in fact, you've gotten the wrong information, and you've got much, much longer to go. Having contractors look over your structure, you should ask them to tell you how they can help you reduce energy consumption.
We're approaching our last 12 or 13 minutes. We can probably work in another couple of phone calls. Let me give our numbers again. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 to be live on the air with our guest, Jim Quigley. Elsewhere, including on the Internet, listeners may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, or in Champaign-Urbana, several local lines, 333-WILL. Jim, my wife and I recently have been in the process of having a new home built, and we did make the choice to put in the geothermal system. And it took several of those loops down 150 feet into the ground to help heat and cool our home. And we're eager to see this winter how much savings there is in
the bills. That's wonderful, Steve.
How
long ago did you do this?
Let's see. Summer before last, we had this. No, I guess, yeah, I think this, maybe. I really can't remember. I think it was the summer before last we had the system put in, but it hasn't been up and functioning yet for a full year. So,
and what was your expectation as to how long before this the additional cost of the installation would be offset by your savings?
Well, it did cost more to put it in originally, but it looks like we'll be saving enough if the predictions are accurate to pay for the extra cost within a reasonable number of years. So we were pleased to do it, partly for that reason, but partly to try to avoid using up more fuel than we're entitled to.
Well, congratulations.
We do have another caller waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Jim Quigley. Yes, line one?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. This is somewhat of a change of subject, but would you talk a little bit about the people you helped when you were in the Peace Corps? I was very interested in that.
Well, I'd be happy to put in a plug for the Peace Corps, what they call is the toughest job you'll ever love. There have been I don't know how many thousands by now, people who have taken 2-3 years or longer to live in someone else's country and learn to speak their language and observe their customs and try and do something to assist them in what they've invited you to their country to do. And of course, there are people who are in the medical field, in agriculture, animal husbandry. They're teaching. They're teaching English. They're teaching math and science. They're helping people build things. They're engineers. They're business persons. They're generalists. And the Peace Corps typically looks for people who are willing to make that commitment of at least 2 years and have the skills they're looking for. The host country is asking for assistance and will give you a place to live in exchange for your input to assist them and their needs. I couldn't say enough about what an important experience it was in my life, and I believe that anybody, even in your listening audience, who is a former Peace Corps volunteer, would acknowledge it was a very important experience for them. And you make friends, you make a lot of friends, and you change yourself in the process. I would like to get back to the issue of energy by just observing this, that there are many Peace Corps volunteers who are involved in these kinds of projects that are attempting to save energy. Fuel is a real premium in a lot of countries, and there are Peace Corps volunteers involved in renewable energy projects in various countries around the world.
Jim, you mentioned that you it was while you were in the Peace Corps and on that island in the Pacific where you helped set up a wind-generating energy system. Windmills are controversial. Even the newest ones apparently are still a bit noisy, maybe dangerous to birds. They're certainly huge, sometimes 400 feet high, as high as a 40-story building. I guess my question is, who's going to have to look at them?
that's a good question, and I think that that question, Steve, gets to the heart of a choice of values. I give presentations on this to various audiences wherever I go, and I like to use a slide. That imagine, if you will, one of these long cascading series of high voltage lines on these big steel towers that stand 60, 70, 80 feet high, and they go across the landscape for hundreds of miles. Would you rather look at that? Or does the picture of a windmill out on the horizon displease you? Would you rather look at a tall stack that's emitting a plume from the combustion of coal that will deposit acid rain all over the countryside? Would you rather not use electricity at all? I think there's nothing inherently wrong with using electricity. People really don't want electricity. They want to be able to turn on their TV.
Sure.
They want a cold beer. They want a hot shower. They want to get from point A to point B, but how you do that work gets the issue of how we use resources. And we can provide that resource, we can provide that electricity by much more sustainable means. I'm using a waste vegetable oil in a 20-year-old Volkswagen. I've got a Volkswagen Golf diesel, and with a simple heat exchange I put into an auxiliary tank, I can put preheated waste cooking oil into the engine, and the emissions from this are drastically reduced from standard diesel fuel. And the fuel is essentially free. I can gather it from, as I'm doing presently, from a local Chinese carryout, and I just have to filter it and put it in the tank. There are more and more people doing that. Can we fuel the entire fleet of vehicles that everyone is using around the country with waste cooking oil? No, clearly not. But when you think about, in New York, for example, I'd like to think of New York City as the Saudi Arabia of waste cooking oil. You know, the restaurants, the hotels, the fast food chains, the donut shops, on and on and on. There's an abundance of this material, and it's typically taken by the rendering industry and used in manufacture of cosmetics and soaps and so forth. But a lot of it ends up as a waste, and it shouldn't be disposed of in the sewage treatment system. It could be used as a fuel. And there are school buses that could be fueled with this waste oil. So many children around the country are exposed to diesel exhausts within the buses that take them back and forth to school. And typically, these buses will drop the kids off in front of their schools with the engines idling and expose everybody around the school to this cloud of diesel exhaust. And diesel creates all sorts of problems for our respiratory systems with extremely fine particles. And the way we get products to basically every retail outlet in the country, they're shipped by truck, which gets to the cost, of course, of the rising cost of fuel and how that's passed on in almost every product that we purchase. And I guess coming back full circle here, we have to find more sustainable ways of fueling our infrastructure, and we have to be more creative about how we use energy, and we have to be wiser about it, of course.
It happens that I know, Jim, that your late father, Harold Quigley, was a leader in the ethical humanism movement, and I had the privilege of interviewing him on the radio before his death. Was his concern for ethical humanism something that has guided you in your life choices about being devoted to sustainable energy?
Well, it touches me that you should mention him, Steve, because he was very pleased to have had an opportunity to be interviewed by you. He had a profound influence on my thinking, of course. Here was somebody who was raised in an orphanage and went on to graduate from college and become an activist in his community. He was a preacher for many years and became involved in the ethical humanist movement. And during the 1960s, was very active in the civil rights movement. He had gone down to Alabama and Mississippi during the Freedom Summer to do voter registration. His life was threatened. He'd been involved in getting the first African American to be elected to be a mayor of a large city. That was Carl Stokes in Cleveland, Ohio, and had been active in the peace movement and women's right to choose movement, and was really quite inspirational to me, and I would never cease to be amazed at his level of energy and his determination to remain informed and enlightened, to allow what he did, not what he said, to be the real gauge of his contribution to his community. I've been speaking to you, and I've been speaking to your audience, and these are words, of course, and in the end, we're all judged by our actions. Let what we say be followed by our actions, and I think that that was the thrust of ethical humanism, is that you're the real ethical issue is in the deed, not the creed.
We're down to our last 3 or 4 minutes. Let's go back to the first issue that you raised that we really didn't do justice to, and of course we can't in just another 3 or 4 minutes. But in terms of the climate change, how can anyone, now that we're facing another hurricane tomorrow in Florida, think that there hasn't been a major impact of human choices affecting the environment?
Well, the data are there. In terms of the increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they're very accurate, and they're collected from bubbles in the ice of ice cores that go back hundreds of years. And we have extremely accurate readings because of the technology today to gauge the chemistry of the atmosphere. We know that carbon in the atmosphere is greatly increasing. And if tomorrow all around the world, we stopped putting carbon into the atmosphere, the amount that is there is still going to impact the change in atmospheric chemistry. Conservative estimates would have us see over the next century an increase of 1 or 2 degrees in average global temperature. But more liberal estimates put it up at 4, 5, or even 6 degrees over the next century. And the former is less catastrophic. The latter would be a calamity. And we're seeing the impact, I believe. And again, I'm not an atmospheric scientist. I'm not a physicist. But I've read enough on this, and I've heard enough on this, and follow this very carefully. While the actual number of violent weather incidents may not be up, in other words, the frequency of them, certainly the intensity of them is up. And the most recent hurricanes are good examples. The way in which they raced up to a Category 5 was almost unprecedented, and where they respond closer in the Caribbean and how quickly they moved, that was unprecedented. And I've heard some who are observing this carefully say that this is just an indication of what's to come. But I don't want to leave on a gloomy note. That we have to prepare. We do have to be very cautious about this. But it should compel us all further to finding more wise uses of our resources and looking at this in a very critical way.
We are out of time. Thanks to our guest today, Jim Quigley, Director of the Center for Sustainable Energy at Bronx Community College, part of the City University of New York system, talking to us by phone today from New Jersey.
It's a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
And thanks also to our listeners who called in with questions or comments. Let me remind folks of just a few of the bits of information shared today. The website for the Center for Sustainable Energy is CSEBCC, B as in Bronx, BCC.org. There's also the Energy News Network, ENN.com, that was mentioned, another website, RenewableEnergyAccess.com. Look for Energy Star ratings on various appliances and in architecture. Look for LEED. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith. I'll be interviewing next week a representative on peacemaking. The following week, a representative from New Orleans, Jean Marie Peacock, talking about churches, the effect of the hurricanes on religious institutions, particularly churches in New Orleans. Later in November, The Secret Gospel of Mark with Stephen Carlson. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Consider a future world in which a vaccine makes you continually happy or a chip in your brain lets you communicate telepathically with your spouse. Sound far-fetched? Well, it may be a matter of when, not if. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll speculate on the post-human future. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered showers this evening, then a slight chance of showers after midnight. The low in the upper 30s with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 40s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, decreasingly cloudy with the low in the mid-30s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.